From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's 19th century transcendentalists left their mark in great classics, Walden, The Scarlet Letter, brilliant essays, and in compelling ideas that God is immanent in each person and in nature, that individual intuition is the highest source of knowledge. But the transcendentalists, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Louisa May Alcott, and more, were not just icons. They were neighbors and friends. Now author Susan Cheever pulls up the shades to show us the intertwined community of these free thinkers at the heart of so much American literature and idealism. This hour on Point, Susan Cheever on the lives and loves of the great transcendentalists. You can join the conversation. Are these still your guiding lights, the countries? And do you want to know about their really private lives? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Susan Cheever. She's the best-selling author of 12 books, including My Name is Bill, a biography of Alcoholics Anonymous founder Bill Wilson, and Home Before Dark, a biographical memoir of John Cheever by his daughter. Her new book is American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau, their lives, their loves, their work. Susan Cheever, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's wonderful to be here.
Also with us in the studio today is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Susan.
Do you describe yourself as a transcendentalist, Jack? We'll see. We'll see. All right, here we are. Susan Cheever, you're taking on this sort of pantheon here of great names, in part because their imprint on American life and sort of view of life and the world is so deep, in part because they were neighbors and friends and chums who hung out together and had a lot of personal history. What took you down this path?
Well, I went down this path for two reasons. One was an accident. I was asked to write an introduction to Little Women. I thought I had read Little Women. I had read it a long time ago. I had seen the movie. And when I reread Little Women, I was just astonished. It is not a book for teenage girls. It is a book for the ages. It's an astonishing novel. I mean, it is also for teenage girls. But I just was knocked out by it, by her ability to tell a story, by her ability to characterize, by her ability to write scenes, by all those things that we think of when we talk about the best kind of fiction. So then I turned to the biographies of Louisa May Alcott to find, according to one biographer, that Laurie in Little Women was based on Henry David Thoreau. So that took me completely by surprise. Mm-hmm. I hadn't even known that Thoreau lived across the street for years and years and years when he was living in the Emerson house. Then I found that Louisa's favorite novel that she had written, the novel that she thought was going to be her breakthrough, was called Moods. That was another surprise for me.
Different
and
color.
Then, right. And then I read that partly Moods didn't do well because it got a really savage review from Henry James. So at that point, I thought, what on earth is going on here?
You came in through Louisa May Alcott. Are you now an acolyte of the transcendentalist? Do you read a little bit of Ralph Waldo Emerson before bed every night or hang out at Walden Pond with the spirit of Thoreau?
I don't read a little Emerson before bed every night, but there is a little bit of Thoreau that I try to live by. There are certainly bits of Walden that I think work very well for me as, personal credos, if that's even a way to put it. You know, another thing I wanted to say about how I came to this book is that, looking back, I realized that the first trip my father ever took me on was to Concord, Massachusetts.
John Cheever, when you were 11
exactly,
years old, if I recall
I
from the book.
11 years old. His mother lived in Quincy. My grandmother.
You didn't get out much, Susan. Was it the daughter of a writer, 11 years old, before you took a trip?
That's right.
Okay.
We were poor, like many children of writers,
right,
and like the transcendentalists.
Yes.
And we didn't have an Emerson in our lives, or perhaps we did. Perhaps.
What was your impression when Papa John Cheever took you to Concord, Massachusetts?
Well, I thought it was great. I thought it was very interesting. I did think these people were a little bit frozen in time.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw where Sophia Peabody had scratched "Man's accidents are God's purposes" on the window of the old man's. And even then I thought, ooh, this is a rented house. Is it okay to write on the windows of a rented house? Because we lived in
the 11-year-old notes
a rented
for future
house.
Reference.
Well, our lives were were much like the Hawthorns in the sense that we lived at the charity of a wealthy family in a rented house. Mm-hmm. So that got my attention, but I didn't rush home and scratch on the windows.
So as the daughter of a great and ultimately very well-known and widely read author, you were very attuned to how the personal could flow in to the professional, even the philosophical. We want to go to how that unfolded in this intertwined group there in Concord, Massachusetts. But, Jack, let me turn to you for a minute first just to speak to the impact, the imprint of the Transcendentalists, why they stand as such a beacon in American literary, philosophical history.
Well, I mean, I think you say it. I mean, they are our primal writers. I mean, it really begins there. I mean, Fenimore Cooper, I suppose, before them, or Irving, and so on. But the European influences felt there, whereas these were the originals, and their voices were original. No one ever wrote like Thoreau before. No one ever wrote like Melville after or before. And no Awesome. Voice in literature can come close to the Delphic. Unforced brilliance of Emerson. Mm. So this was the American voice at its inaugural moment.
And before we go back to their personal lives, how do you see their imprint on the American character, capital A, capital C, if we can use that phrase today?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that it's a difficult one. I mean, I think they're there as a kind of counter tradition to the turn the country took. The country took a turn toward industrial capitalism. That was not for them, although Emerson thought very highly of railroads and money. But all of that, the mass man, the conformity, the rote and the routine, the whole notion of mass production. All of that is antithetical to their organic ideas.
No, not to Emerson, not so much to Margaret Fuller, who became the editor of the Herald Tribune.
And really, worked with him on the Dial.
Really more to Thoreau, I think. And Louisa certainly was not of the Luddite camp, to characterize what you're saying. So I think it's really Thoreau who was so anti-materialistic. To my mind, these people came up with the kind of humanism and the kind of ability to get solace from nature that is very prevalent today. And they were the first people to have the relationship to nature and to animals that we're just coming around to with Peter Singer and people like that. In other words, another thing about them that I love so much is that, unlike quote-unquote great writers, capital G, capital W, they are not a bunch of womanizing drunks. They are...
The daughter speaks.
They are sober. They are vegetarians. They are men and women of the highest moral character, and yet they write as well as any of those other writers with a capital W. And I think it's amazing that the first community of professional writers in this country really goes against the whole idea that in order to write great literature, you have to somehow be an irresponsible clown.
So they looked for the divine in humans, in nature, looked to individualism, self-reliance, a rejection of traditional authority, and you find in them the roots of environmentalism, of feminism. Emerson, of course, writing, "A man is a bundle of relations, a knot of roots whose flower and fruitage is the world." A bundle of relations is what your book is all about. Introduce us to your core cast of characters
here
in their
setting.
Well,
my book is really about the community, and you brought up such an interesting question before, or I thought you were bringing it up, about the appropriate relationship of someone's life to their work, and how much we should know about someone's life when we read their work. And, of course, when I was growing up and there were dinosaurs who walked the earth, there were two camps. One believed that you should only read work in an absolute vacuum, and that you should look at paintings without knowing anything about the artist. And the other group believed that you should know as much as you could possibly know. Now, that first idea has been lost in our culture. There is no one now who goes to a museum
read in a vacuum,
and blocks
come
out the information.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one who reads a book, takes off the flap copy first in order to experience the art of the writer
because
without
knowing anything about the writer. Because it's all contextual, and we embrace that now.
We have embraced context and information and personality, which is the dark side of this embrace, in a way that is really unprecedented.
Well, start with the core personality here, then, the sort of money, the great one at the time in the midst of all this, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Give us the personal profile.
Well, Emerson You know, these people were what is called in academic circles a genius cluster. And there's been a lot of research done on genius clusters. The founding fathers, for instance, were a genius cluster. And I've come to think that often a genius cluster requires a charismatic figure at the center with a lot of money. Emerson was that figure.
Why did he have money?
He was married to a very beautiful woman named Ellen Tucker. She was sick. She was young. He adored her. When she died, he was devastated. He sued her family for her share of the Tucker fortune. And he took, in 1836, he sued her family. He sued her family and got the Tucker money, went to Concord, bought that big house, and started creating this community.
And building a further fortune on lecturing all over the country. He was wildly popular.
Yes, wildly popular. And he had a lecture schedule that makes a book tour look silly. I mean, he was in city after city after city, day after day after day. So the combination of the Tucker money and his lecturing money allowed him to bring all these people to Concord and often to support them for years after they got there.
To be great is to be misunderstood, he wrote, but he was well paid in any case. Jack Emerson here will come to the circle around him, but there he stands, that kind of Delphic voice, as you say, in the middle of this community.
Oh, yes. And I lived in Carlisle for 10 years, and our whole
next
life
door to Concord,
revolved around Concord. And how I wish, Susan, I had had you a book. It opens Concord for everybody. I'm sure it has a lot of local readers who just must say, let's take our walking tour with Susan.
Yes.
Well, Concord as the sort of original stomping grounds of a big piece of the American mind here. Susan Cheever is our guest. Her new book is American Bloomsbury, about the private lives of the transcendentalists. You can join us at 800-423-8255. Susan, Jack, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the private lives of the transcendentalists, Emerson, Hawthorne, Thoreau, Louisa May Alcott, and more, the high-minded and very human circle that set the course of so much American thought and literature. My guest is Susan Cheever, who her new book is American Bloomsbury. You can join the conversation. Did you ever dare wonder about the really private lives of the authors of The Scarlet Letter, Little Women, Walden? Do you want to know how they lived and loved? Can you feel the cross-pollination, the genius cluster Susan Cheever describes among the transcendentalists, the flow of energy and ideas? Does the great Ralph Waldo Emerson call out for the lifestyles of the literary great treatment? 800-423-8255 is our number. That's 800-423-TALK. Susan, I wish you'd describe the community here, their lives, how close they were, the sort of begin to give us the web of their interactions. What was their circle, their cluster?
Well, it really started with Emerson and his desire to finance and start a literary community. But F.O. Matheson had famously said that all of American literature was written in 5 years, between 1850 and 1855. Mm. And what amazed me was to find that it was almost written in three houses in those 5 years.
And remind us of the output of those years and houses.
Oh, Melville, Hawthorne, Poe, Whitman were out of the houses now. Emerson, Thoreau were back in the houses. Louisa May Alcott, Margaret Fuller.
And the works they came up with in that
Walden,
tiny cluster of years.
Moby Dick, The Scarlet Letter, Little Women, everything.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. It's really incredible. And throw in Henry James.
So while they were writing, how were they interacting? What give us a sense of this community.
Well, they interacted a great deal. And, of course, their fictions, and they all wrote fiction, were influenced, as fiction is, by their real lives. Hawthorne and Emerson never got along. Emerson thought that Hawthorne wrote too much about the past. Mm. Hawthorne, who really was not a naturalist or transcendentalist in the sense that we were talking about before, thought that Emerson was too much of the great man about Concord. Mm-hmm. Emerson was very much the big man on campus.
Full of himself in Hawthorne's
view. Exactly. But both men were very, very interested in Margaret Fuller, a woman, an astonishing woman who has been largely forgotten.
She's not on the Rushmore carvings of
She's
this era. Introduce us to Margaret Fuller.
Carvings.
Maybe
Margaret
she should be.
Fuller, she definitely should be. She's certainly of the same stature as some of these quote-unquote transcendentalists.
Who was she?
She was a woman who was educated by her father as if she was a man. So she had Greek, she had Latin, she had German, she brought German literature to Emerson. You know, she had the kind of education that was thought of as a man's prerogative in those days. It was a big thrill when Harvard allowed her to use their library. Of course, there was no question of her going to college.
But women, she wore her boldness right on her sleeve.
Well,
she was smart.
Mm-hmm. She was smart. And she didn't mind being smart, although she may have been conflicted about it ultimately. And I think for these men whose wives or for whom the model of being female or feminine in those days was extremely passive.
Even these men, these free thinkers.
Even these free thinkers thought that women were inferior in every way. Even these free thinkers thought that the female intellect was somehow inferior. They were free thinkers, but they weren't about to give women the vote. 80% of the electorate voted in those days, but of course none of them were women. Mm-hmm. Anyway, even these free thinkers thought that women were inferior. So here comes Margaret Fuller, not interested in marriage, not interested in playing the piano, not interested in singing, interested in Nietzsche, interested in, you know, Plato, interested in the same things they were interested in, able to talk about them. And they were, both Hawthorne and Emerson and many other people, including Hawthorne's wife, Sophia, were entranced by Margaret Fuller.
What do you mean by entranced? What's is here exactly?
Well, Margaret Fuller gave, many of them gave what were called conversations, which were sort of interactive lectures. In the conversation was a very popular form of entertainment.
What does this mean, interactive lecture?
Sort of like movies today. Well, they would get up and give a lecture, essentially, but they would also
Q&A, let's talk.
They would also Q&A, like a book tour. And Margaret Fuller's conversations, like Bronson Alcott's conversations, were extremely popular. But Margaret Fuller's book, Women in the 19th Century, was really a forerunner of modern feminism, and a large piece of that book shows up in Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. In other words, she had a very direct influence on Hawthorne and his work.
Did he fall in love with her? Did Emerson? What's the evidence?
What does it mean to fall in love, Tom?
You tell us in the 19th century in Concord, Massachusetts. What did it mean? A rustling of skirts and a glance in the hallway?
Well, I don't think these people, I don't think there was a lot of physical interaction or any at all. I could find no evidence.
You've got
of
a whole
any
chapter here entitled
physical interaction.
Sex.
Well, yes, perhaps it should have been titled No Sex. Sorry.
Okay, but love by some or infatuation, or is that what you're intimating
here? Well, I think
here,
sometimes or, if there is no
or just
no
intellectual
sex,
enthusiasm.
I think they were infatuated. I think they were enchanted with each other. Certainly between Margaret Fuller and Emerson, there were many, many letters about whether or not she was threatening Emerson's marriage.
So transcendental sex.
Which was, yes, that's a good way to put it, which was pretty easy to threaten.
But this was a woman of high spirit. She ended up in Italy, as I read here.
She was amazing.
What,
she
had
became
a child by an Italian general in the revolution there,
yes,
sailing back to
yes,
the States. They both die 100
yes,
yards from
yes,
shore off Fire
yes,
Island in New York. Yes. Tragic ending.
Horrible ending. And Emerson, devastated, sent Thoreau down to Fire Island to see what he could find. He found her lover's coat, Isolde's coat, and brought back a button. But she really was like a cannonball in the pool of Concord ideas.
So is the case you're making that the kind of electricity that crackled around a woman like Margaret Fuller powered the creative product of these great American geniuses?
It certainly had a huge impact on it. And, you know, Margaret Fuller's journals, all these people kept copious journals. And in her journals, she talks about loving Hawthorne and loving Emerson. And as I say, in their letters, they just stop at being explicit. So between both of these men and Margaret Fuller, there was tremendous connection.
Is there something from the Scarlet Letter you might read that would carry some of that charge?
Well, I could certainly read a scene from the Scarlet Letter. And this is a scene where Arthur Dimmesdale, Hester Prynne's lover, mm-hmm. meets Hester Prynne in the woods, and they talk about, they did have sex, they talk about what happened between them, and it's very much like a scene in Hawthorne's journal where he runs into Margaret Fuller in the woods. Okay, I'm going to read it.
Great.
They run into each other by accident. Without a word more spoken, neither he nor she assuming the guidance, but with an unexpressed consent, they glided back into the shadow of the woods whence Hester had emerged, and sat down on the heap of moss where she had before been sitting. When they found the voice to speak, it was at first only to utter remarks and inquiries such as any two acquaintance might have made, about the gloomy sky, the threatening storm, and next the health of each. Thus they went onward, not boldly, but step by step, into the themes that were brooding deepest in their hearts. So long estranged by fate and circumstances, they needed something slight and casual to run before and throw open the doors of intercourse so that their real thoughts might be led across the threshold. After a while, the minister fixed his eyes on Hester Prynne's. "Hester," said he, "hast thou found peace?"
And the doors of intercourse slide open. Susan Cheever reading from Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, and maybe Margaret Fuller behind that. Jack Beattie's with us. You can join us as well at 800-423-8255. Let's take a call from the Stomping Grounds, Concord, Massachusetts. Barbara's calling. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was really fascinated with Margaret Fuller because since I live in Concord, we hear a lot about the men, but not too much about Margaret. And so I was, after I'd read Susan Cheever's book, then I was looking on my bookshelf, and I came across a different, very different depiction from a book that was written in 1915 by a man. And
which book is that, Barbara? Do you call
Emerson, and it's by O.W. Firkin.
Okay, from way back.
Well, I was surprised, but it said she was not a strong soul with speech as its appropriate and exclusive vehicle. She was a formless being to whom speech imparted the semblance of organization.
Wow, that's 1905 talking, maybe.
This is 1915, so that was almost 100 years ago. And I was wondering if Susan Cheevers thought that there was some of that view still alive today, or if perhaps it had changed over the past century, because obviously 1915 was a lot closer to the actual time of her life.
And he paints her as a kind of wallflower. This, for the woman who wrote, "In order that she may be able to give her hand with dignity, she must be able to stand alone." Susan, Margaret Fuller is less robust than you might think?
I completely disagree with that assessment, but also I think there's a reason why that might have happened. After Margaret Fuller died, she continued to exert such a huge influence on this group of people that Henry James called her the Margaret Ghost, because they didn't stop thinking about her. She haunted them. And Emerson put together a little book of essays in remembrance of Margaret Fuller. And Hawthorne's contribution to that book of essays was to completely run down Margaret Fuller and to say that she had never amounted to anything and that she was, in fact, sent from the devil. I mean, it was a very angry, I think, grief-stricken assessment of her. And many, many people have just taken that at face value and not looked at what came before between Hawthorne and Margaret
Fuller.
It's
unfortunate that she survives as the butt of a famous comment by Emerson. Someone said to him, "Margaret Fuller accepts the universe." And he said, "By gad, she'd better." And she also survives in a corner of Henry James's portrait of Miss Birdseye in the Bostonian.
That's
she's
right.
a little bit
well, now we're
one of the Peabody
them,
sisters, but she's also a good deal of Margaret Fuller and a very unflattering portrait, to say the least.
I certainly, if we're going to draw lines between fiction and life, I certainly prefer to see her as Hester Prynne in The Scarlet Letter. And I think that's a far better portrait of who she was and what she represented than Miss Birdseye. But yes, both these men, who had been clearly enchanted with her when she was alive, turned on her when she died. I think that that's pretty easy to understand.
Jack, can you feel or imagine or project the love and heat of this bold woman, the strong-willed siren in the work of these great American masters?
Well, we see her reflection in these novels. And I think you're right. The novelty of a plain-speaking woman, a woman who had the audacity to speak in public, her life is really parallel to that of Elizabeth Peabody's, who's the subject mm-hmm. of a wonderful book by Meghan Marshall, nominated for the Pulitzer Prize last year. And her task was being taken seriously by these men.
Exactly.
There was before her this endless flow of condescension that she had forever to deal with. And even when she was being taken seriously, then that was held against her because she was too mannish. So she couldn't win being a strong-minded, what we would think just being an independent woman in those days was a damned if you do and damned if you don't.
And maybe still a little bit, she wrote, and who might not still relate to this, "Let it not be said," wrote Margaret Fuller, "whenever there is energy or creative genius, she has a masculine mind." I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Harvard, Massachusetts, out Concord Way. Kara's calling. Hi, Kara. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to see if Susan had discovered anything about the time that Louisa May spent out here in Harvard. Prior to moving to Concord, she was out at Fruitlands, which was a commune started by her father, Bronson, with other transcendentalists, and it apparently failed because they were gabbing so much they couldn't put up enough supplies to last the winter.
Right.
And then she moved down the hill from Fruitlands, which is a museum today out in out here, and mm-hmm. she moved down the hill to Still River Village, where Louisa May's family rented the house next door to us for 6 months prior to moving over to Concord. And in the house that we're in, supposedly Louisa May played here and was very influenced by the woman who lived here at the time, Mrs. Gardner. She was apparently a very educated woman, Louisa May played with the kids that were here, and I wondered if she had any other idea about the influences during this period in her life. We have an article, I don't know how true it is, from the Historical Society here from the 70s that said that this house that we're in and trying to renovate was the setting for Little Women,
and we're
trying to track that down and didn't know if she had any opportunity to discover some of the influences in this period of Louisa May's life.
Yeah, Susan Cheever pays plenty of attention to that, Kara. Let's turn to her. Here's a call from where the ghost may still walk.
Exactly. That's a long question. I think the failure of Fruitlands was certainly a turning point for the entire Alcott family.
This utopian community, Bronson Alcott, the father,
Alcott,
very much at the middle of it.
Don't get me started on Bronson Alcott, but he was he was a great man, capital G, capital M. He wore a cape. He had a lot of hair. He had a cane.
He struck the pose.
What did Henry James said? He had a mind too fine to be violated by an idea, but in fact, Bronson Alcott had a mind too fine to be violated by the necessity of making money. So he always with Emerson's support. Almost everything Bronson Alcott did in his life was done with a check from Emerson.
Mm-hmm.
Started a utopian community. He brought some people from England, and the cast of characters at Fruitlands is fairly hilarious. I actually spent a lot of time on them in the book because I thought it was so funny. But Bronson Alcott, of course, was far too intellectual to till the soil, and he also believed that it was wrong to take milk from a cow unless you had the cow's permission, that it was wrong to eat a bite of fish. Louisa May Alcott wrote a wonderful book called Transcendental Wild Oats about Fruitlands. Very, very funny treatment of Fruitlands. Anyway, when Fruitlands failed, and Emerson, of course, took one look at it and said, "Oh, they're doing fine in June, but we'll see them in December." Anyway, in the winter, of course, Fruitlands failed, and Abba Alcott, Louisa's mother, mm-hmm. moved the whole family down to Stillwater, where you live. And that was really, there was a huge shift in power in the marriage. In other words, at that point, it became clear that Bronson Alcott's sometimes brilliant ideas were just not going to yield enough income to support this family. Bronson Alcott went into what sounds like a clinical depression, and his wife just took over, moved them down to Stillwater, and eventually back to Concord. And I think we were talking before about what a woman is, or mm-hmm. what is feminine and what is not feminine. And I think that Louisa May Alcott also provides a very interesting model of how to be a woman without being a quote-unquote feminine cipher. That's my opinion mm-hmm. coming through, mm-hmm. even as Margaret Fuller does. And I think that one of the reasons why Louisa had the strength to be the unconventional, iconoclastic, astonishing woman that she was that she saw the balance of power in her parents' marriage shift so definitively at that point.
And maybe in that hungry winter, Ford's the daughter who later wrote, advised, resolved to take fate by the throat and shake a living out of her, not to be hungry at Fruitlands. Susan Cheever's with us. Her new book is American Bloomsbury. You can join the conversation. Are these ideas you still live by, the ideas of the transcendentalists? What do you make of Susan Cheever's take on the greats? And how about that Margaret Fuller? How do you see the impact of these human and inspired writers today? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site, offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles. 617-859-0540.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the private lives, the really private lives, of the transcendentalists Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, Louisa May Alcott, Margaret Fuller, and more, the high-minded and very human circle that set the course of so much American thought and literature. My guest is Susan Cheever. Her new book is American Bloomsbury. You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And if you think that the surround of these men and women is not still with us, listen to just a little bit. Be reminded of Thoreau and Walden. Susan, read a little bit, if you would, and remind us of how Henry David Thoreau was woven through this story.
I'm just going to read a few lines from the chapter called Where I Lived and What I Lived For. And as I pointed out earlier, Walden was the beneficiary of almost 9 years of rewriting. So this is not only a paragraph that I would live by, but also one that I would write by. Its sentence structure is as extraordinary as its feelings.
Rewriting and a lot of support from Ralph Waldo Emerson, very material.
Yes, yes, Emerson. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms, and if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world, or if it were sublime, to know it by experience.
And you'll hear echoes right there all the way from Twain to, you name it, Saul Bellow. Jack Beattie, you've read Ralph Waldo Emerson on his buddy.
Yes, and a point about those 9 years. One of his most famous lines is, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation." But an early version of that sentence reads, or that thought, "A stereotype but unconscious despair is concealed under what are called the amusements of mankind."
Oh, my gosh.
Boy, it takes
Editor.
9 years.
Rewrite. Get me rewrite.
Let's hear it for
And
rewrite.
here is Emerson on a, if not fault, a trick of Thoreau's style that puts off some readers, me included. The trick of his rhetoric is soon learned. It consists in substituting for the obvious word and thought its diametrical antagonist. He praises wild mountains and winter forests for their domestic air, snow and ice for their warmth, villages and woodchoppers for their urbanity, and the wilderness for resembling Rome and Paris.
And we are beguiled. That's great. Let me take a call from Bill in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Nice talking to you.
Great to have you.
And, Gee, I'm a student of Thoreau. I've studied him. I've read Emerson, but I've read just overall. I've studied Thoreau for the longest time. And you talked about, first of all, what turns me off, first of all, about Thoreau over Emerson. Emerson just seemed kind of dry to me. Whereas Thoreau was more the poet and the writer that we wrote with such great imagery and poetry, like time is but the stream I go fishing in, I drink at it, blah blah blah. And you know, if you build castles in your air, your work need not be lost.
That is where they should be. Now put foundations under them,
et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, you're talking about the subject of condescension to women in them days, which Thoreau himself was not free of. But you have to also think of the context of the times, and plus the hot topic of the time also was anti-slavery, which Thoreau was very passionately into. He was very much, he met John Brown, and he stood in for Frederick Douglass when Frederick Douglass left the States in a ship because he was afraid of being associated with John Brown. And so Thoreau stood in for Frederick Douglass once on doing a lecture.
Right. Bill, you raise a subject that Susan Cheever is particularly attuned to here. With John Brown, it was a real rock in the pond for this crew, Susan.
Yes, John Brown went to Concord twice, and as you point out, they adored him. I think, against their better judgment, I find it amazing that people who felt that they couldn't eat a fish because of the suffering of the fish would welcome a murderer into their ranks, but they
remind
did.
Us of his fiery deeds.
John Brown, and it's true, it was an act of war, he would say, was part of a posse of vigilantes who murdered a group of men in Kansas in the most appalling way, you know, chopping them into pieces in front of their families and that kind of thing. And
as part of an anti-slavery crusade.
Exactly. And it wasn't something he kept a secret. He brought the Bowie knife, which had been used in the murders to Concord on his second visit, and brandished it.
And the gentle transcendentalist
and
said, Alcott, right on.
Who wouldn't milk a cow without its permission, thought that it was great. And I think that the cause of abolition was so passionately espoused by these people. They had helped runaway slaves. They were deeply involved in fighting the Fugitive Slave Act. Their hearts were so completely in it that they were blinded by that and welcomed this rather questionable character into their ranks. In fact, after John Brown was arrested, Franklin Sanborn, another man who had been brought to Concord by Emerson, was targeted by the federal agents who came to get him. And when they knocked on his door, he raised such a fuss, his sister ran and rang the church bell. Everyone in Concord turned out. The federal agents were sent packing and Franklin Sanborn escaped to Canada. So it was an extremely passionate community when it came to anti-slavery.
Yes, they really warmed to Brown. I mean, the famous remark of Emerson's that he made the gallows holy. And here is Thoreau. Some 1,800 years ago, Christ was crucified. This morning, perchance, Captain Brown was hanged.
Exactly.
Wow.
And
wow.
Bronson Alcott as well. I think he really hoodwinked them using their passion and innocence as his tools.
A lot of passion running there. Let's go to East Lansing, Michigan, and Lauren. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm enjoying the discussion today, but I wanted to bring up Margaret Fuller one more time.
Mm-hmm.
I am I'm an English grad student, and I'm reminded of my very first essay ever written, and it was on the Blithedale Romance by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he has a character, Zenobia, and I did a little date crunching while I was listening to the conversation today, and it appears that was published 2 years after she died. And I think that the character Zenobia is a much more accurate, I guess, representation of how he may have seen Margaret Fuller.
Lauren, describe Zenobia for us as she appears in the Blithedale Romance.
Oh, she's a highly conflicted character. She's extremely intelligent. She's desired by all the men. And by the way, Blithedale Romance is actually the creation. It records the creation of a commune, very similar
Brook
to
Farm.
This sort of community that the Transcendentalists had that you're talking about today.
So you see her more there than in The Scarlet Letter.
Oh, exactly. And what I find astounding is that he actually kills her off in the end. And I believe it's a drowning don't quote me on that, or yes. a suicide or a mistaken drowning, and he's in love with her, everybody's in love with her, but she is this character who doesn't fit because she's extremely intelligent for a woman, and the narrator has all these conflicted feelings about loving her.
Well, Lauren, you're great. Susan Cheever, you've got a close reader here.
Lauren, I completely agree with you. The portrait of, if we're going to draw lines between fiction and life, the portrait of Margaret Fuller in The Blithedale Romance is even more electrifying than the portrait of Margaret Fuller in The Scarlet Letter, especially that scene where he first sees her and her dress is sliding down over her shoulder and she has a flower in her hair. And you're absolutely right. He does, in the end, Zenobia does die by drowning, which is, of course, how Margaret Fuller drowned. As I said before, and as Henry James said, in a way, The Scarlet Letter was also written after Margaret Fuller's drowning. So in a way, in her death, Margaret Fuller, I think, became more alive for these people. But you're completely right about The Blithedale Romance. Hawthorne lived at Brook Farm, which was a commune before he went to Concord, and there was Margaret Fuller.
Lauren, you're wonderful. Thank you for calling. Let me get a call from Wayland, Massachusetts, and Lee. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I wanted to speak from a personal point, which is my family is a direct descendant of Margaret Fuller.
Oh.
My great-grandmother was a Fuller, who I unfortunately never met, but her two daughters, my great-aunt and my grandmother, for the years that they were alive, used to sit their granddaughters down and tell us about our relative Margaret Fuller.
Now, how does that? She died in a shipwreck with her child. So how does she have direct descendants?
Well, I believe she had siblings for which they were descendants.
Got it.
And so they what their point was to us was, you know, women are strong, that men should never dominate or take over their minds or opinions. And it was expressed to us, whether it was true or not, but we all believed at the time, that upon her death, Emerson, to quote unquote, stole her ideas and wrote them as his own. So their point to us was, you know, never let, like I said before, let a man dominate your life and be who you are and be strong because you're women.
And watch out for those men. They're rascals.
Right.
Wow. The very great aunts and grandmothers keeping the Margaret
That's
Fuller
great.
Message going, Susan.
That's great. Well, not only did Emerson steal her ideas, but Hawthorne stole her life.
Well, that's so true.
Or memorialized her, depending on how you want to look at that. But it's so great that happened in your family. I wish it would happen in the whole world.
Lee, keep the flame. Hold the torch there. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Hartford, Connecticut. And Lori. Hi, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment. Margaret Fuller and Emerson were both Unitarians, I believe. I know Emerson was, and
sure.
I know the Unitarian Church in Hartford has a Margaret Fuller room. It's a room dedicated to Margaret Fuller.
Hmm.
And I just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, well let's look at that, the relationships there, Unitarians and this crowd and crew. Susan Cheever, what do you say?
Well, you know, they were Unitarians in their most conventional moments. They even turned their back on the Unitarian Church and became transcendentalists, humanists, people without a church. They didn't go to church. And, you know, Emerson really ended up being quite bitter is perhaps too strong a word, but he really had no use for church. He had once been a minister, and he felt that the church couldn't accommodate the changes in his beliefs. And in fact, he was 86th from Harvard for a famous address he gave at the Divinity School, saying that God was not to be found in church, but rather to be found in other people and in nature. So, yes, they were Unitarians in the loosest possible way.
Let's go to Northampton, Massachusetts, and Anne. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Really early on in the conversation, you had mentioned about these writers being some of the first people or the first people who talked about a relationship to nature, and I was just thinking that, you know, all through the history of this country, really Native Americans have always articulated that relationship, you know,
mm-hmm.
leaders and thinkers, and I was kind of curious whether any of these writers knew any Native American people or if they were influenced by them and what their stand was on the treatment of Native Americans. And
it's an interesting subject. Americans in the neighborhood?
It's a good question. Well, Thoreau, you know, was very in tune with the Native Americans, but the rest of them weren't. And I'm not sure. You're absolutely right. You know, we're talking as if white men were the only people who ever walked the earth. Mm. The Native Americans' relationship to nature, in many ways, I'm sure, forecast the transcendentalist relationship to nature. But the Native Americans didn't leave writing, or their writing was destroyed, and so it's hard to track it. But I think that's a very interesting point.
Emerson wrote a scathing letter to President Van Buren at the time of the transfer of the Cherokee. Mm. And it was just an eloquent denunciation of
the Trail of Tears.
The Trail of Tears. Mm. And according to Joseph Wood Crouch, Thoreau's last words were moose and Indian.
Make of it what you will. You know, Susan, you've got readers who have loved this, and then you've got very scholarly readers who have been sort of put off at the, you know, hoi polloi treatment of these greats, and also have raised questions about your title, American Bloomsbury. It's very catching, but they say, well, that's so different. That's Virginia Woolf and John Maynard Keynes and E.M. Forster in London. They were a close conspiracy, and they were all snobs. Why are you referencing Bloomsbury when you talk about this crew?
Well, the title of this book has its own history. We all wanted to call it American Parnassus, but we were advised that that wasn't a good idea. So I use Bloomsbury as a kind of code word for genius cluster. But in fact, let me say, the Concord people beat the Bloomsbury group hollow. They were much better writers, and they came first.
By a long shot.
So in a way, I felt that Bloomsbury was a title that didn't quite give these people the glory that they deserve. But it was the best word I could think of to mean group of writers.
Jack, you know, what do you make of, I mean, Susan here, the daughter of a giant writer, John Cheever herself. So she looks to the personal and she finds lots of meaning, the genius cluster, the kind of pinging of one mind off another. Hawthorne wrote in The Scarlet Letter, he wrote, "No man for any considerable period can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be the true." Mm-hmm. That would suggest maybe it does matter to know, you know, what the face is in private.
I think it does, so long as you don't reduce the one to the other. I mean, no,
exactly.
It would be very hard to maintain a consistent respect for Joseph Conrad if you knew about the frustrations and the temper tantrums of his life. It's better not to know in some cases. But you know what? What strikes me about this crew is they were darned admirable.
They were amazing. I mean, there's nothing bad in their lives. So in fact, if you're going to investigate the lives of great writers, these are the ones to look at.
We've got a minute left. Give us an anecdote to savor as we go out, Susan. A moment, an interaction between some of these folks.
Well, my favorite story, and it just took a new twist, is Louisa May Alcott writing Little Women. She wanted to write a book. She had been in the Civil War. She'd come back. She went to her editor. She said, "What's my next book?" He said, "I can't sell anything you would write except possibly a book for young women." And she said, "No, expletive deleted way." Oh. She didn't say that. I'm paraphrasing. "I'm not doing that. I've come too far to do that." And he said, "Okay." And he wrote to Bronson Alcott saying, "Your daughter won't do this. I think she should." And then he said to Bronson Alcott, "And if she writes this book, I will also publish a book by you, Bronson." Yes. So Bronson Alcott wrote to his daughter saying, "You have to come and write this book for young women, because if you do, not only will you get paid, but Thomas Niles will publish my book because he is an admirer of us both." And wow. So Louisa May Alcott, in a rage, to benefit her father and her family, went back to Concord under the worst possible circumstances, wrote one of the best-selling books of all time.
And said later, "I am angry nearly every day of my life, but I've learned not to show it." Louisa May Alcott. Susan Schaefer's book is American Bloomsbury. Susan, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks a lot for joining us
today. Thank you.
Jack, always great to see you. Thanks for coming down.
Pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.